about whether or not you can believe the Gospels. And as a reminder, this is not a class for you. I know that you believe that we can trust the Gospels. This is a class on how to talk to people who are agnostic, who aren't really sure. Maybe they didn't grow up believing the Bible. They probably heard the Bible referred to in derogatory ways, that it's a book of myths and fairy tales and things like that. So that's what we're talking about during the course of this class, is whether or not we can trust things. We talked about the writers of the Gospels and who they were and what their biases were and whether we could trust the words that they put down in print. And we talked about whether the manuscripts have survived intact to this day and realized, yes, they have, better than any other ancient document. Even skeptics acknowledge that the Bibles are historically accurate and that they can be trusted. So today we're really going to address the key question. Whenever you're studying with an agnostic, this is the question that needs to be asked and answered. And if they agree with you on this one point, the most important question in all of human history, then you've won the battle. The Holy Spirit has won the battle. God has won the battle. If they can answer this question in the affirmative, and that is, can we actually believe that Jesus died on the cross and rose from the dead? Two separate questions. Did he die on the cross? And did he raise from the dead? Because if he did, that changes everything. That is really the key question. Because that question encapsulates a whole lot of other doctrine inside of it. And that's because Jesus didn't rise from the dead unless there's a God. And in fact, unless he is God, he is part of the Godhead. So that answers the question about whether or not there's a God. It answers the question about whether Jesus was God himself. Because people just don't rise from the dead. A lot of you in here study dead. You know what dead looks like. And people don't come back whenever they're dead. That's just a fact. I mean, aside from a few people, you know, you can stop breathing or your heart stop beating and you can be resuscitated and things like that. But I'm talking dead. Bad dead, as we used to call it. We used to say, you know, like, you see roadkill, and it's like, yeah, that possum is dead, or no, that possum is bad dead. You know, once you get to be bad dead, you don't come back. And when Jesus died after that, all the things he went through, he was bad dead. So, yes, Jeff.
Amen. How long do they consider you dead without breathing?
It depends on a lot of factors. And I'm sure that Lynette and some of the others of you in here are a lot more familiar with them than I am. But generally, after about 3 minutes without oxygen, your brain starts to die.
Your heart goes asystole when it stops.
Right. And that can be extended if your body is extremely cold. When somebody goes down under the water, you know, it's almost like suspended animation. And people have been brought back from a lot longer whenever their body is cold and their metabolism slows down and they require less oxygen to the brain. But oxygen to the brain is the key thing. I mean, that's what kills everybody, is lack of oxygen to the brain. You're not dead as long as your brain has oxygen. But when it doesn't, then you're dead.
And how long with our Savior in the tomb?
3 days.
Dead.
Now, you don't know at what point he was resurrected, but, you know, just looking at it objectively. But he was in there for a while. In there. And so that's what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, because some people think he was just out cold.
Exactly, yeah. And so we're going to address that today. That's one of the key things. Like I said, there's two questions. Did he die on the cross? And did he raise from the dead? Because anybody that agrees with those two things, you've agreed to the gospel. At that point, once you realize he rose from the dead, you have no further excuse for rejecting the gospel, because there is only one explanation for that. And at that point, you're just rejecting God. If you say, yes, I agree, he died on the cross and he rose from the dead, but I'm not going to change my life, okay, you've made your decision at that point. There's nothing further that can be done for you until you change your mind about that. Okay, so, you know, we're used to the fact that when people are dead, they stay dead. There are a few specific examples in the Bible whenever that changed, but in the natural course of events, that's what happens. That when somebody's dead, they just don't come back, and yet that's what we're teaching people happened. So that's what we're expecting people to believe. And so we need to have some evidence if we're going to present somebody with the fact of this person was dead and now they're alive again. And we need to be able to convince them. So, but there's a lot of claims to the contrary. There is a documentary where they found what's called ossuaries, bone boxes, if you want. In 2007, there was a documentary that said there were some found. And they were labeled Jesus, son of Joseph, Mary, Joseph, Mary Magdalene, and Judah, son of Jesus. These were found in 1980 in or around the area of Jerusalem. So, you know, that's one of the claims. There are claims that Jesus didn't really die of his injuries, that he was put in the tomb and then, you know, he recovered. And so that's what happened on there. There are people that say, well, Pilate really wouldn't have killed him because he was advocating paying taxes to the Romans. And so why would Pilate want to kill him? So Pilate conspired to pretend like he executed him and then, you know, actually whisk him away and, you know, had him treated and he revived, I guess, if you want to talk about that. So some people just claim, okay, Jesus did die on the cross, and his body was moved. You know, the apostles or somebody moved the body so that they could say, here's the empty tomb. So that's some of the things that we're going to try to address today. We're going to talk about whether or not any of those things are plausible. And if they're not plausible, why are they not plausible? What evidence could you present to an agnostic to say your theory really doesn't hold any water? So if you've got somebody like that that you are studying with or are considering studying with them, it would be a good time to take some notes today so that you have some specifics to address with them. So how do you study something that happened 2,000 years ago? And how, you know, what kind of facts do you accept on there? Really, what you're looking for is, you know, assessing the likelihood by looking at what evidence you do have. So there's not any eyewitnesses or anything, but what have people written? You know, sometimes you read Aesop's fables, but you know that they're not true. They've got talking animals in them and things like that. And so you look at them and it's like, why would you ever think that was true? They're obviously not written as true stories. There's no witnesses, you know, corroborating or other thing to say, oh yeah, animals used to talk, you know, back during those times. We know that's not true. And so based on the evidence we have, we can say, no, those are not actually true stories. So in looking at historical recordings of events that happened, they have what's called the three R's on there. And that's relevant sources, responsible method, and restrained results. So those are the three R's that we're going to talk about. Relevant sources, what has been written? You know, obviously you start with the New Testament, with non-Christian sources, early church fathers, people a generation or so removed that talked to eyewitnesses. All of those people are relevant sources. You've got responsible methods, and that's giving weight to reports that are a lot closer to the events. If something is written the day after something happened, you can trust it a lot more than something that was written years and years and years later, or even decades later, or hundreds of years later in some cases. So eyewitness reports are best. You know, those are the best evidence that you have in a lot of cases. I saw this happen. Anything beyond that starts to become hearsay. If you're in court, it's like, well, you know, so-and-so told me this happened. Well, that's not admissible in court, but I saw this happen. That's what they're looking for, eyewitness reports. Embarrassing details, believe it or not, is something that lends credibility to a story. It's like, okay, why would somebody make this up and tell it? You know, this makes me look bad, so if I'm going to say it, it's probably true. You know, one day I got out at the gas station and grabbed the car door and slammed it like this. Slammed my fingers in the car door. I wouldn't tell you that if it didn't happen because it's embarrassing. I wouldn't just make up a story like that and say, here's this really stupid thing that I did that hurt a lot. You know, I'm not going to tell that unless it's true. But instead, it was kind of like, all right, this was so stupid, I just have to tell it. You know? Sometimes you've got a story like that. And then obviously corroboration. You know, more than one person telling the same story lends credibility. And that's what you're looking for with evidence. Okay. Restrained results means not reading more into it than what the facts would dictate. So, you know, sometimes you can jump to a conclusion that's really not supported by facts. So restrained results means I'm going to read this and I can gather from this that this happened. I can't logically conclude that this happened. Like, for example, you've got a witness. Okay, the police arrived and found them in the house with somebody that died. Okay, you might can safely assume that they have some knowledge of what happened. You can't automatically assume that they're at fault for what happened. So, unless you've got other evidence that points in that direction. Okay, so what historians use is what's called a minimal facts approach. What that means is that these are facts that everybody accepts, everybody considers to be true. Even skeptics will admit that certain facts are true, that the evidence supports them. There's always a lunatic fringe that's going to disregard everything. You know, I don't believe we went to the moon, and I don't believe that this happened, and you know, there was a conspiracy to shoot John F. Kennedy, and Roosevelt knew about the attack on Pearl Harbor, and you know, you've always got conspiracy theories and theorists and everything. But the mainstream group of historians will agree on certain facts on here. So what they came up with minimally accepted facts. First of all, is that Jesus was killed by crucifixion. People pretty much, there's not really any doubt about that, that Jesus was killed by crucifixion. So, even people that don't accept the Bible as the inspired word of God accept that that's a logical thing that happened that is supported by evidence. So, besides the Bible, there's a Roman historian, Tacitus, that has described it. A Jewish historian, Josephus, has acknowledged it. A Greek satirist called Lucian, and the Jewish Talmud. All of these agree that Jesus was crucified. And if you accept that Jesus was crucified, you've pretty much got to accept the fact that he was dead. The Roman soldiers knew how to kill people. I mean, that was their function in life, was to kill people. I mean, to an extent, that's the role of the military today, we always said, is to kill people and break things. And so everybody's role, if you're a part of the military, is to support that effort of killing people and breaking things. And so if you're a cook, you've got to feed the people that are going to kill people and break things. You know, it all kind of goes back to that mission. Well, that was the mission of Roman soldiers, ultimately, was to kill people. So, just like you studied dead today, they studied dead too. They knew how to kill people because if there was somebody that was supposed to be dead that wasn't dead, then they could be dead. So, they had a very simple logic flow there. You tell me this person needs to be dead, I'm going to make them dead. So somebody really didn't survive crucifixion all that often, especially not when they were flogged beforehand. I mean, the flogging brought you almost to the point of death. 39 lashes with these whips that's got sharp pieces of bone and stuff in the end. It's going to lay your back open to the point where you can see the bones in there. And so that's already going to be somebody that's not really likely to survive. And then you throw crucifixion on top of it. They're up on the cross where they can't breathe. They got to lift themselves up just to be able to breathe. That's just not something that people can survive all that easily. So if you accept the fact that Jesus was crucified, you accept the fact that he died on the cross. Yes.
In the Bible, there's so much detail about how he died and everything mm-hmm. involved that a modern-day doctor could look at it and say, there's no way he could survive this.
Right.
And that's why he has the details. So there's no doubt of what he went through, what his body would normally go through, or your body would normally go through, that there's so much detail in it that you can take that doctor today and say, yes, there's no way he could survive.
And even if he wasn't quite dead when he came off the cross, which we know that he was, but even then, he still wasn't going to survive. You know, you don't just recover from that.
When you're stabbed in the side and your blood's turning like water, that medically your body's not transferring oxygen or anything anymore. There's no. That's why I put so much detail in it. There's no doubt whatsoever on the medical result of that crucifixion.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so, but you know, if somebody's been flogged and they've been on the cross for 6 hours, and you took them down and rushed them to a modern trauma center, I don't think you could bring that person back. So one of the facts that everybody pretty much universally accepts is that Jesus was killed by crucifixion. So that's not really in question. So if we're addressing whether he died on the cross and whether he was raised from the dead, yes, he died on the cross. That part's clear. So really what we're addressing is, did Jesus rise from the dead? Because that's the key thing. And if you're studying with an agnostic, if you can get them to agree that, first of all, Jesus died on the cross, and then that he raised from the dead, that's it. You've accomplished your mission. At that point, it's up to them if they want to follow through with that and make the changes that logically follow with admitting that Jesus was the Son of God and he was raised from the dead. Okay, people universally accept that Jesus' disciples believe that he rose and appeared to them. Notice I said that they believe that. There's a difference in perhaps what you believe and what is true. A lot of people believe things that aren't true. You might believe in Santa Claus, but that doesn't make it true. So there is a difference, but everybody pretty much accepts. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to rock your world, Russ.
I'm just saying they're my ears. Wait a minute.
Hey, there are three stages in life. You know, you believe in Santa Claus, you are Santa Claus, and then you look like Santa Claus.
I look like Santa Claus.
You're transitioning now from stage two to three, so you just got to start growing on the beard. All right, so everybody pretty much agrees that Jesus' disciples believe that he rose from the dead. I mean, there's a lot of writings. I mean, 1 Corinthians 15, 3 through 7 was written about 55 A.D., plus or minus a little bit. And it says that Jesus appeared to the apostles after the crucifixion. And so, you know, Paul obviously believed that and wrote it. The other apostles obviously believed it because they went on to preach and teach and meet untimely deaths based on this fact that they believe it. The early church fathers, Clement, Polycarp, were just one generation removed, and they wrote about this as fact in there. The sermon at Pentecost, this is a very short time after the crucifixion. Lots of people there that were there when it happened, you know, they're already teaching this event at that point. So, and there are so many disciples that suffer terribly because of their belief. People just aren't willing to be persecuted and be martyrs for something that they know is a lie. So that pretty much says that the disciples all believed that he rose from the dead. So that's pretty much a universally accepted fact. That Paul was converted, that's a minimally accepted fact. That's pretty much historical record that Paul was persecuting Christians and then he became one. So, and not only became one of the most outspoken advocates for Christianity. He didn't have anything at all to gain by making this conversion. He had lots of stuff to lose by making this conversion. He was a wealthy, well-educated person, esteemed in Jewish society, and he was going to throw it all away to become a poor traveling preacher, essentially, that was going to be persecuted and beaten and eventually executed for his beliefs. Okay, another minimally accepted fact that even skeptics acknowledge is that Jesus' brother James was converted. So, John 7:5 tells us that Jesus' brothers really didn't believe in him. This is one of those examples of an embarrassing story. I mean, it's kind of bad whenever you're a prophet and your own family thinks you're crazy. You know, that doesn't give you a lot of credibility. And that's not the kind of detail that would have been put in that wouldn't be true. Because if that wasn't true, who would make that up as a Christian writer? Yeah, his brothers didn't really believe in him. It's not a selling point on there. So that's one of those embarrassing details that was included that lends credibility to the story. And at Jesus' crucifixion, if you want a little more evidence, who did he entrust care of his mother to? To John. Not to his brother James, but to John. So that tells you at the point even of crucifixion, James probably wasn't a believer. And so that kind of tells you that Jesus wanted his mother cared for by one of his followers and not just by a blood relative at that time. So, excuse me. We've got the fact that he did die as a martyr according to Josephus and Clement. The Bible doesn't tell us how Paul died, but these early church fathers did write about it. You know, once again, people don't generally allow themselves to be martyred for a lie. So this is something that was accepted. Did I say Paul a minute ago? I meant James. I'm sorry, I was a little bit running behind here. James, we're told, was martyred. That he not only became a Christian, he became the leader of the church in Jerusalem. So that's a big turnaround. Whenever you've got that ingrained of an idea, for the first however many years James was around, maybe 25 to 30, if he didn't believe in Jesus being the Son of God and being the Messiah, something very dramatic would have had to happen in his life to turn him around. And Paul tells us that the risen Jesus appeared to James. That you know, that's a dramatic enough situation that you can turn your life around. The same as Paul. Paul viewed the risen Jesus, and that was what made him turn his life around. So that's some fairly strong evidence. You know, everybody accepts that Paul and James were converted, but both of them were in a position where that would have been very difficult to do without extremely overwhelming evidence. Just like you suddenly deciding that Jesus wasn't the Son of God. You know, you've been dedicated Christians, something very profound would have to happen to you to change that faith. And the opposite would be true for them. Somebody that disbelieves that strongly, for them to change overnight and become a strong advocate, some life-changing event has to happen. And it was very clear, another thing that's minimally accepted things, is that the tomb was empty. There was no question about that. They were preaching, you know, days afterward about the risen Jesus. If the tomb was still sealed and he was in there, that would undermine their entire philosophy. So there's no question the tomb was empty. So either Jesus was resurrected or somebody moved the body. That's the only two possibilities. So let's look at some of these other possibilities. These are the minimally accepted things. To us, it provides clear and convincing proof that Jesus rose from the dead. But not to everybody. So let's address the other options and talk about them. A guy named Michael Bagent, in something that he called the Jesus Papers, he says that this was the theory I mentioned earlier, that Pilate conspired to make it appear like Jesus died on the cross, and then he revived him using aloes and myrrh and brought him back to life. You know, to begin with, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, medical people, aloes and myrrh, I don't think are a miracle drug that brings people back from the brink of death. And even if they were, Jesus went through a lot. I mean, 3 days after somebody's been flogged and crucified, they're going to be horribly maimed. That's not going to inspire a lot of confidence in God's healing ability if he's got to be hauled around on a stretcher or in a wheelchair, which is probably going to be the case if somebody was brought back from the brink of death after what happened to them. So he didn't, I mean, even the Bible says Pilate really didn't want to crucify him. It's just that the Jews forced his hand. They were to the point of saying, hey, we're going to elevate this and go above your head and take this to your boss and say, hey, he's not keeping the peace here because he's not making us happy. So, you know, essentially they had to resort to extortion to get Pilate to accept it. You know, finally it's like, okay, you know, what's one more Jewish guy dead? I guess I'll go ahead and wash my hands of it and say, okay, go ahead and do it just to keep the peace. So the Bible was clear, you know, it agrees. Pilate didn't want to have him crucified, but he did. He finally went along with it. So you know, let's look at Paul. I mean, suppose Paul had a change of heart. Some people will teach that, but there was no reason for it. There's no logical reason why somebody right in the midst of this campaign to go and throw Christians in jail would just stop halfway to a place and have this major life conversion. Like I said, it would take something very dramatic, like Jesus stopping and talking to him and saying, hey, why are you persecuting me? Because Saul at the time was a religious man. He was a devout Jew. He'll tell you, I was a devout Jew. And so whenever this happens, I mean, he's going to follow the will of God. And so whenever the resurrected Jesus appears to him, that is a life-changing event a person of faith. So there's just not really any other explanation for that other than the risen Jesus appeared to him. And even the other people that were with him on the trip, I'll be with him just in a second, they acknowledged that something happened. They didn't understand the words. They said it sounded like thunder, but they saw some light and they heard the sounds, and so even they acknowledged, hey, something happened on this trip.
Examples, simple examples people don't even realize. Jesus had a great following. So at his death, he had a great following watching that death. So they would recognize that that wasn't Jesus on the cross, and they would know that nobody would be able to survive that. Perfect example is that Peter tried to blend in, and people recognized him because he was one of those who were following Jesus.
Right.
So there would be no way, but just the simple putting that documentation into the Bible, letting people realize that Peter was recognized when he was trying to hide. Jesus would be definitely recognized on the cross and through what he goes through. There would be no excuse that was Jesus on the cross and that's the one that died on the cross, because if he's out in the open for all the public to see, and Peter tried to hide, and he was still recognized, there was no way that Jesus could escape that recognition.
How many people did Jesus appear to? We have records of that.
Yeah.
Over 500 people. So this is not just like, okay, I appeared to a few key apostles and they told everybody else, yeah, we saw Jesus. He made no restrictions on himself about appearing in public. He wanted everybody to see him. And so he went out of his way to appear to people and let people see that he rose. I mean, this created a whole generation of eyewitnesses to his resurrection, specifically for that purpose. Because if he had just appeared to a couple of people here and there, then that would have been kind of suspect. Yes. Russ and Brian.
Well, I think one of the significant things also is that you have a testimony of a Roman centurion that was charged with crucifying Jesus, that surely he was the Son of God, that he died on that cross. He was the one that was charged with the crucifying.
It scared him.
Yeah.
When people die and there's suddenly an earthquake and dead people rise and walk around for a little while, and the veil on the temple randomly splits from top to bottom, which is in itself is significant. I mean, you know, somebody could help it at the bottom, but this is a big, tall curtain and everything. It doesn't just start at the top whenever it splits. You know, this was a significant event on here. And it was, I guess you could say, an earth-shaking event.
That's good. The other significant point is that as the centurion, and even the guards of the tomb,
absolutely.
So you're not about to mess up and say, oh, yeah,
right.
You're going to find some other scapegoat to try and take it.
Exactly.
So,
like we said when we started, that was their whole purpose, was to kill people. And they were good at it. And they knew when people were dead.
You were saying, because it talks about that in Mary Matthew chapter 27, verse 35, about people that rose from the dead. Christ wasn't the only one that rose from the dead. He said many holy people rose from the dead. If I was dead and I rose from the dead, who are the very people I'm going to go see? And my family. And
sure.
And that talk is going to spread like wildfire. Mm-hmm. God made that event so large and so big when he had a major earthquake that created, which is documented in history. Mm-hmm. You can go back and follow to when that earthquake occurred. Mm-hmm. A huge earthquake occurred. The dead, the holy people, chosen people, wasn't just random people. The holy people who knew the word, that this event would occur, and all that to be spread out. This event was so large, there's no way that it could be hidden.
Uh-huh, exactly. All right, so let's talk about a little bit different interpretation. Could his resurrection have been spiritual? I mean, after all, you've got 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul says that your body is sown physical and it's raised spiritual. So there would be some evidence that could have been the case. But Jesus already thought about that in advance. Whenever Paul's writing in verse 50, he says that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God. But flesh and blood means mortal in that sense. But in Luke 24:39, Jesus says, ghosts don't have flesh and bone as I have. And he made a point of eating on there. Ghosts don't eat. Spirits don't eat. So he let Thomas actually touch the wound. So, it was very clear that this wasn't just a spiritual resurrection. You've got those three pieces of evidence there where he could already tell what people were going to say. He already knew, and in fact, one of the first heresies that developed was Gnosticism. And that was one of their components, was that you can't be perfect unless you're spiritual. Because flesh can't be perfect. And so, therefore, Jesus must not have risen in his flesh there. He probably just had a spiritual resurrection, because that way he could be perfect. But he went out of his way to show, no, I had a physical resurrection.
With that, he gave the example ahead of time. He raised Lazarus from the dead. And Lazarus coming out of the tomb, and remember, Lazarus coming out, he was wrapped, and he had to literally hop his way out of it. So he was bound by those.
Right.
Christ would show them.
Definitely not a spiritual.
What it would look like.
Yeah.
He would be physically bound, and somebody would have to literally help him unwind. But that wasn't the case with Christ.
Right. And in the description of the tomb, the scarf around his head was folded and put in another place and everything. It wasn't just that they were just dropped where they were and he became a spirit and floated out of them or anything. You could tell somebody physically handled these things and took them on. Okay. What about hallucinations or delusions? People have those. People have hallucinations. So could Jesus appearing have just been a hallucination of a lot of different people? What do y'all think?
Maybe to one, but not to five.
Okay, to one. But the people that are in a group don't all have the same hallucination. That's not the way hallucinations work, because they're a creation of your own mind. And so you can have an individual that has a hallucination or a delusion, but not a whole group that has the same one. It's just not a thing. It just doesn't happen. You can use trickery to deceive a whole people like a magician does, but people don't just have this mass delusion or mass hallucination the way that some people think they do.
Dale, also, it is possible to have a large group of people to see the same thing, but those things have occurred when people are under the influence of something that causes those hallucinations. There is absolutely no evidence whatsoever in any of those appearances that anybody was under the influence of anything. And so that just bears mentioning, realize that, it's possible. Because that's oftentimes when hallucinations occur, when people are under the influence of something. But no evidence written anywhere that suggests that that was the case.
Yeah, these were normal just people that, going about their normal business.
Hallucinations caused by blood.
Exactly. And also, those don't account for the empty tomb. In addition to that, the tomb was empty. So if people merely had hallucinations, you wouldn't have an empty tomb to go with that. That would have been an unrelated. That wouldn't have been related to it. So, all right. So, let's get into the more likely possibilities. Moving the body, because that is a logical explanation for why the tomb would be empty. And in fact, that was even mentioned in the Bible of the apostles and. Were believing he was going to rise from the dead, so let's post a guard so that nobody moves the body. So, first of all, that doesn't make a lot of sense, because nobody had a reason to move the body. If you look at it, Pilate didn't want to move the body. He had a vested interest in Jesus being dead because he had ordered it. He had nothing to gain by having soldiers move the body. The apostles didn't have anything to gain. I mean, after Jesus was crucified, Peter's like, oh, well, that was a fun 3 years. I guess I'm going fishing. You know, as far as he was concerned, this is over. You know, I thought he was the Messiah. I thought he was going to come and sit on David's throne and establish an earthly kingdom. And I was going to be right there at his right hand. And you know, this was all going to be a great thing. And, well, okay, he's dead now. So I'm going to go fishing and everything can just go back to the way it was. So if Peter didn't seem to have any interest in moving the body and seemed genuinely surprised when Jesus came back, they had nothing to gain. I mean, all they had to gain was heartache, really, by moving the body and living a lie for the rest of their lives. All they were going to gain was persecution and eventually execution for this. So why would they do that? So that you just don't change your life for the worse in order to satisfy a lie that you created. There's no motivation there in order to do that. So it doesn't make any sense. All right, I brought up earlier, just to intrigue you a little bit, these ossuaries or bone boxes that were found in 1980. So let's talk about those. Okay, let's first of all just take at face value that there were bone boxes found that had the names of Jesus and Joseph and Mary and Mary Magdalene and Judah. Excuse me. First of all, these were very common names during this time. Statistically, it says one out of every 79 males in Jerusalem would have been not only Jesus, son of Joseph. They could have really benefited from a baby. They didn't have a lot of names. A lot of people had the same names, you know, like George Foreman, all of his George Foreman kids. You know, they repeated an awful lot of names, and they were historical. They were based on, you know, family names and things like that. So these names really got repeated a lot. It's not like the thousands upon thousands of different names that people have today. And then just so they're different, they spell them differently and everything. That just wasn't a thing then. You had a small group of names that got repeated over and over and over. So there would have been statistically 11 men in Jerusalem during that period that would have fit the profile of Jesus. So even if you accepted there was a bone box labeled Jesus, son of Joseph, that is not absolute proof of anything, because there would have been a bunch of people that fit that description at that time. The documentary also doesn't mention there were 35 of these ossuaries in there. This wasn't like this group that had just these ossuaries that had Jesus, son of Joseph, and Mary and Mary Magdalene. This was just a big old group of bone boxes. And so there was nothing to indicate any kind of a family relationship between these. So if you just have 35 bone boxes with the limited number of names that you've got, you're going to have some Josephs in there. You're going to have some Jesuses in there, and you're going to have some Jesus, son of Josephs in there, just statistically. That's likely to happen. The one that's attributed to Mary Magdalene doesn't say Mary Magdalene on it. It said Mariamne Mara. They decided at some point that that was Mary Magdalene on there, with no real evidence beyond what I just presented to you. Mara is in fact short for Martha, not Mary. So you know, there were lots of Marthas, and there just happened to be one in there. But you really have to twist that to try to make that be Mary Magdalene on there. And their source was called the Acts of Philip, that book on there. And this was a 4th century book, by the way, not written by Philip, as we talked about in one of my previous classes. And it talks about, it doesn't ever say that Mary was married to Jesus, you know, the popular movie, The Da Vinci Code and everything. Even that text doesn't say anything like that. And in fact, that book, The Acts of Philip, requires celibacy. So that would, if they're using that as a reference, that's not a very good reference for them. Besides the fact it's not historical, it also doesn't teach what they're trying to use it to say. Because that would have required that Jesus be celibate and not have this child that they say was in these bone boxes. So it was just media hype, is all it was. It was something that, hey, the public is probably gullible and uninformed enough to believe this if we state it. So it's really not evidence at all. So where does that leave us? The five minimal facts that I went through are not really challenged by anybody, so all that's left is to draw a logical conclusion for them. And the logical conclusion is that Jesus raised from the dead after he was crucified. That's really the only answer that fits the facts. We've examined the other options of moving the body, that Jesus didn't really die, and none of that holds water. None of it makes any sense. There's no reason that you would have to believe any of that. There's nobody that would have been willing to move the body. Nobody had anything to gain by moving the body on there. So if people are presented with this, it's really just a choice. They are left to make a decision. The evidence points to Jesus being risen from the dead. And so if they're not willing to face that conclusion, then that's just a personal decision probably made because they don't see that they have anything to gain by it and that they have lots to lose. Because the logical conclusion, if Jesus was raised from the dead, is that he's the Son of God, that he in fact is God, and that as such, as our Creator, that he has the right to expect something from you. And a lot of people really don't want to face that because that means giving up control of their lives and becoming a servant of somebody else. And we don't like being servants just by nature. So we've got to have an overwhelming reason. Having someone who created us and who gave himself for us to save us is a pretty overwhelming reason for us to give up our sovereignty and become a servant of somebody else. Closing thoughts. Okay. Walter, would you close us in prayer, please?